Hey, Geekscapists, welcome to a brand new Geekscape episode. I'm Jonathan London, if you haven't heard of Geekscape, and we're going to be talking movies, video games, comic books, television, any of that pop culture creative stuff. I'm sitting here in downtown LA, not in the Westwood One Studios because it's Labor Day, and the Westwood One Studios are closed on the Mondays that I record my show. So I'm recording here with my buddy Tanoosh, and he's a filmmaker that I've known for, Tanoosh, I think it's close to 20 years now.
A long time.
It's definitely, it's like 16 years that we've known each other. And we are here in his, your downtown LA apartment, creative studio. And I looked up at Comic-Con a few years ago, and Tanoosh was like in front of the Geekscape booth. And I was like, what? What are you doing here?
That's right.
And I had kept up with Tanoosh because he's very active. He's making a ton of films. Huge on the indie scene. I'm just going to throw that at you. You are huge on the indie scene. He came out of the gate. I remember like we all kind of graduated around 2005, 2006. And you came out of the gate within a year or two and had a movie at Sundance. And then you kind of didn't like let up on the pressure. Like you just keep making movies. I'm here in your creative loft apartment. And you're editing a movie I never even knew you were making, that you shot a few months ago. And Geekscape, the reason I reached out to Tanoosh was he's got two movies out this month. When I saw that fact that you had not only two movies out this month, but two movies with a diverse cast.
That's right.
I was like, nope, got to get you on the show now. Because what you told me that day a few years ago in front of the Geekscape booth at Comic-Con was that you secretly had been listening to Geekscape.
That's right.
So as much as I've been keeping up with your film career, you've been keeping up with my talking career. That's crazy.
That's right. No, I mean, there was a lot of nights. I remember between New York when we were together, living together, or living in the same city.
Yeah, we were in film
school. And before I came to LA, I was living, you know, kind of in the Bay Area, my parents' house at home, kind of like figuring out the next steps, mentoring kids, creating like workshops for filmmaking.
Is that what you did after grad school?
Some of what I did.
You went back to the Bay Area.
I went to the Bay, and I had a lot of nights where, you know, I couldn't sleep for whatever reason, dreaming of the next project.
This will cure it.
Man, that came out completely wrong. No, that's usually when I do all my like researching, is when I'm like up and crazy and manic, and I needed to hear a voice that could talk about the things I love, like comics, movies, you know, and just a source of information, and Geekscape was there for me. and nonetheless, it was run by you, you know,
right.
And you and your co-hosts would just I'm not gonna say put me to sleep every night.
No, it was comforting. It was a comfort for you. You felt like you were part of the family.
Exactly.
You predate the family. You were family before the family.
True, which is like, you know, normally you listen to your friend podcast and you're like, oh, like, hey, support my friend, go, you know, but it wasn't like I had the initial 2 seconds, oh, go Jonathan, but then after that I was turned into a fan, you know.
Right. I needed the intro. Crazy. Yeah. And when you told me that at Comic-Con, I was so flattered, because your output is really, you know, going back to school, I always thought that people viewed my sensibilities as being fairly studio or fairly LA. And the admission is that I got into USC. I got into USC, which everybody thinks of as the Hollywood studio film school.
It's the feeder, yeah.
I had been waitlisted. So I was allowed to go to start at USC in January, but spend my fall semester at Columbia. I fell in love with Columbia because I wanted the versatility of being able to make a studio movie or make an independent movie like Greg Mottola does, or you know, those kind of directors used to. I chose to not do anything. I chose to talk to people on a podcast. No, but does that make sense? Like I thought that everybody kind of viewed me as the guy who was going to go do studio stuff. The careers I admire, though, are like careers like you, like. Those are the ones that I love.
Well, it's interesting. You know, you always had a fondness for small films, you know, along with all of your, all the things that, you know, obviously really
the Spider-Man stuff. Yeah.
You know, but you always, I remember our discussions were always about like really heartwarming, you know, work. And you were also ahead of your time. Like you were the one like in school being like, I'm going to go to LA when this is done. Like, no questions. I know where I'm going. And even the podcast, I mean, now podcasts are, everyone has a podcast. It's the coolest thing, but you put that out right in the infancy of it. So, I mean, I felt like, you know, you had your sensibility, but you always had, or you had your take, you had, you know, your bigger taste, what people thought of you, but you were always sort of, a little bit ahead of people, because everyone's coming to LA now, you know, and, and I feel like you situated yourself a lot earlier than people back then. You know?
Right. Well, again, flattered. But it's been cool to see you kind of figure out the or navigate the landscape of really independent filmmaking. And talk to me. Like, how did you get that first movie up? You know, because I think we have a lot of filmmakers like yourself, like, who listen to the show. And that first step, arguably the hardest step?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the best steps were the first, like, failures. The first productions I put up that just fell apart. Well
what were they? Because, like, we only saw Punching the Sun.
Right. You know, before I went to film school, I did a couple shorts. And I remember shooting this one, my second short, called Big Brother. I shot in my parents' house and flew in all my friends to help me. And
you flew them in?
I mean, they flew in. Okay. I don't know if I flew them in. But they flew in drove in, however they could get there, you know. But the big thing I didn't understand at that point as a filmmaker was just basic, like, scheduling. How to make a schedule that makes sense, how to make that kind of days. We would just sort of shoot what we were feeling and then not really understand what parts were remaining and what order we should shoot things in, and got to the point where, like, things would sort of fall apart. And I remember just being so low and so down, having so much, like, hope for this film, but then feeling, like, so spanked. And I remember feeling like, I never, ever want to feel that again. I never want to go there again.
I need to put some form to this stuff that, like, these... Because you clearly had something burning in you that had to get out. You had no form.
Yeah, and planning. You know, people think guerrilla filmmaking means that you're just running gun and shooting willy-nilly, but it actually means you have to plan like a guerrilla. You have to train, like, twice as hard because you have less resources.
Right.
And that was the message. That was the thing that really, I think, when I moved on and started making bigger films, or made, like, Punching at the Sun, you know, I organized that. We shot for 17 days, but I organized that thing for 3 months prior, because I just never, ever wanted to feel that way. I never wanted to be so on my ass again as a filmmaker. And so I think experiencing, like, something brutal like that early is actually helps you kind of...
Focus?
Yeah, focus, you know.
Yeah, and so where did it come from? What's it about? Where did it come from?
Filmmaking in general?
No, Punching the Sun.
Punching the Sun, that was, you know, that was a crazy time, because we started film school 2 weeks before 9/11.
I remember.
It was crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, we walked in, you know, and just, you know, things had changed a lot for me.
Because of 9/11?
That one event.
I remember that morning in Lewis Cole's class very clearly, the late Lewis Cole, who... Yeah. I love Lewis Cole.
Yeah, Lewis is
awesome. But I remember walking in and we're like, what do we do now? Because we'd just experienced 9/11 the day before, and we're supposed to go back to school. Like, this all felt pretty trivial.
Yeah, like, we had all these hopes and ambitions, and, like, especially for me, like, I'd always been making sort of cross-cultural work, stuff that sort of put South Asians in the forefront, or trying to create narratives around South Asians, you know. And we had, like, rising momentum. We had a lot of energy in, like, 98, 99. Like, things like Fusion were becoming big. Breakbeats, Talvin Singh was the hit. And then you kind of felt like, in my head at least, I was like, oh, this is going to be the moment I can break out and tell
Asian
my story.
Filmmaking.
Yeah, so, like, Indian-American, South Asian-American filmmaking,
right.
You know.
And it was, because it wasn't just like the Hong Kong thing. It wasn't just like John Woo and I mean, Crouching Tiger came out a few years before. It came out like a year before our film school. So people were starting to look at Asia and India for that stuff. Bollywood was starting to get its attention too.
A little bit, yeah. But, you know, I just felt like even the diasporic South Asian culture, you know, things that are coming out of the UK, like Talvin Singh, Asian Dub Foundation, these kind of fusion projects were starting to kind of gain ground and actually have a lot of artistic integrity to them, you know. And I just felt like, oh, even just narratively, I felt like my story of being here in this country was a moment where it could have happened, you know.
Were you born in this country?
I was born here.
Yeah. But were your parents?
My parents were from India.
And so what was that like growing up? Because you said here in this country, I was like, wait, were you not born in this country?
Oh, well,
I get it, but no, you can feel that way. especially now when we've got neo-Nazis marching around, like, you can feel that way.
Yeah.
You know, if you're anything but white and blonde, I can totally understand you feeling like this may not be your country because people are trying to make it theirs.
Well, that's part of it, but, you know, also I think before I'd gotten to film school, I was producing a TV show in New Delhi for a couple of years. Uh-huh. So I had early on had a kind of global picture of the film game, you know. And so when I say this country, I think it's less about my connection to it, because I definitely feel like an American, you know.
Right.
But I think it's just more about how I talk about the global market, because I always consider what's happening in India, how Indian films are doing in America, and see myself in that media just as much. So I'm always kind of like, I guess I said it in
That understands how you gravitate towards where the fusion movement's happening, because you are the fusion movement.
Exactly.
Because you spent time in both markets, and you in that makes sense to me now, how that whole movement is your thing. Have you stayed true to it? Like, talk to me.
Well, back to 9/11. You know, it's okay. You know, I felt like there was a little bit of a moment 98, 99. You know, it just felt like things were cresting just within our like subculture. Right. You know, and then 9/11 just knocked everything back. Obviously, there was just like new xenophobia, new hatred, new racism, new laws. I mean, even in film school, like our class was something like 60% from international students. You know, and the year after that was like. The admission policy changed. You know, they had to adhere to like all these new things that were being instituted.
I don't know if
you noticed, but it was like very different.
I noticed it. That class is pretty honky. I didn't know that it was an actual written shift. And no, I mean, Bush and Cheney fucked a lot of shit up.
It was crazy. You know, the things we talk about today, I mean, we've already, and that's when, you know, it was funny because my roommate Ziad al-Husseini at the time was from Kuwait, and we had just met like a week prior, and I remember knocking on his door at 9/11 and being like, yo, I just saw the fucking tower go down. Come out here, and we watched the second tower go down. And guess, you know what we both do the moment after? This is like unconscious. We were just in the bathroom. We were both shaving we looked up at each other. We're like, whoa, why are we shaving? And then it just was like a reflex.
Yeah.
It was like that's how much like survival instinct or just whatever was programmed in me, like, and him, both of us, like, boom, no question. We just started shaving. And, that set it off, you know? And then, I won't get into like what was said to me.
But people said shit to you.
Of course.
I think every person I know who lived through that and is Middle Eastern or Indian or just had fucking people say shit to them.
For sure. And I mean, even in class, you know, I had a teacher say something that was like totally inappropriate, you know. But that was, you know, but when I started really getting into the community.
Even after you shaved?
Yeah. Okay. I think that made it more shady or something.
The only thing I noticed when you shaved was you looked 10 years younger.
He's hiding something.
I was like, what's Doogie Howser doing in our class? This guy looks 12.
But it was, you know, I wasn't the victim, though. You know, like, the more I started working in the community, I started going out to this organization in Queens called SAYA, South Asian Youth Action. And they are the only nonprofit organization in New York that serves South Asian teens. Kids have come in from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and they provide all kinds of services to these kids. And that was a community in Elmhurst and in Jackson Heights where a lot of people's parents are being detained and deported in real time, you know. So I started sort of getting involved and volunteering and working on filmmaking workshops, and I started filming their basketball league. They have a basketball league that happened every Saturday. I still have all the tapes. I'm about to transcribe them for Muhammad Mursi OU basketball tapes.
How long ago was that? I mean, but that was while you were at school?
This is like 2003, 2004, right. While I'm at school.
Okay. Yeah, and I'd already moved to L.A.
Even 2002. It was after 9/11. You know, all this was after 9/11. But then I moved there to that neighborhood. I was in Elmhurst for a couple of years, and it was, I think, in that time I'd started writing this script in Lewis Cole's class, of all places, you know, and he was the one who was like, Lewis was crazy, he was just like, Tanuj, he pulled me into his office, he's like, Tanuj, have you written anything before, you know, after reading my pages? And I was like, yeah, man, I write all the time. And he's like, you have a fear of rewriting, you know, and he just laid into me about this fear of rewriting.
Because you weren't making the changes?
I just didn't even think of rewriting as part of the process back then. You know, I was like one take wonder. I was like,
that's
I wrote
the entire
script.
Process.
Yeah.
But like now you look back and you realize rewriting is the entire process.
I don't even start writing until the third draft. You
right.
know what I mean now? But like back then, you know, and I remember Lewis saying that to me and not, I didn't get offended. I was just kind of like, what does he mean by like,
right.
writing is rewriting. But I started the script like 40 pages in his class. And I got to the point where I was like, you know, I need to finish this thing. I finished it, wrote it again.
And that was Punching in the Sun.
That was Punching in the Sun. And then I had a friend come out and help me do a couple more drafts of it.
And you wrote that because what's it about? Because I think that it maybe came out of those experiences in Elmhurst, like with the youth and your direct involvement with them.
Yeah,
I mean, what's it about?
Well, it's about a boy whose older brother gets murdered in a hate crime in the opening scene, and he's dealing with. Just the loss of his brother, who was a hero and a legend in the town. He was like the best basketball player to ever come through the neighborhood. And it's sort of a story about how he's mourning this loss and the complexity of their relationship of like growing up in the shadow of a hero that you lose, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of about his own redemption, and yet it's also about his relationship with his best friends in the neighborhood and his inability to get out of his own way and his own anger and hate, and he's also processing like the messages he's getting from society too, all around him. So it's set in like the specter of 9/11 for sure, but it's actually just a story about a boy coming to terms with loss. Mm-hmm. You know, and I cast it with all kids from the community, all kids that I'd like kind of mentored or worked with, or you know, friends of friends. Like, we just sort of started building this little troupe together, and it really centered around Mishu Khan, who was just a kid, you know, from the moment I met him. I'm like, this, you're the kid, you're the guy, you know, and he was open to it. And it just turns out that he was a gifted, natural sort of actor and reactor, you know.
But he had no intention of being an actor before you came up to him.
No.
He was just a kid you were kind of being like a tutor for, or being like a
mentor.
Yeah,
but he would play basketball in the gym, yeah. And I'd be shooting the games, and I'd see him, I'd see his face, and I'd be like, oh, what's up? You know, we'd say, what's up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you know, the first kind of idea of the script was set in California, where I was from, and more about like a based on these kids that I was mentoring in the West Coast. But then the same kind of stories happen in both communities.
Right.
So I just transposed.
And you were there.
Yeah.
So they're all non-actors in that movie.
The whole movie's non-actors. Yeah. And
holy crap.
Yeah. So we go out there with this rewritten script that we'd gotten the Tribeca All Access with the script, but nothing really, we got a little momentum, but it gave us enough confidence to go out and actually say, hey, we have something here. But it was hard to get people to just kind of back us or get behind us.
Why do you think that is? Because you hear about movies that go through something like Tribeca Access or Sundance Labs and this and that. I just put a script through Lab, and they do get attention, but why wouldn't anybody want to go in?
Well, I tell you, you know, back then, it was the first year of the Tribeca Lab.
Oh, it was?
Yeah, so it was...
People didn't know anything was going to come out of
this. They didn't know. It was so early, we did actually, you know, MTV at one point was really serious about working with us. But it also has to do with my youth. Like, I was very young. I didn't understand how the industry worked. It wasn't like I was repped in L.A. or, like, you know, mm-hmm. things are different here. I was just in film school, and my mentality was ride or die, like... I made everything I made to that date, you know, and I did an 8-12 project, Butterfly, which was made from Afia's script.
I remember.
They'd done really well, you know, and I felt like I had momentum as a filmmaker. I knew what I was doing.
That was beautiful. It wasn't 12 minutes long.
It'll forever be the knock on me.
Geese gave us, after our first year of school or so, we had to do an 8-12 project, which had to be between 8 and 12 minutes long, where we adapted one of our peers' scripts. And Afia, like, what an amazing writer. And she's gone on to make amazing... Like, she made that movie that went to Toronto. I got to see this movie. And she's a Pakistani filmmaker. And you got her script, which is super lucky. And I just remember watching the screening and having this very beautiful movie and being like, yo, 12 minutes came and went, bruh. Like, that movie was like 30 minutes long. I'm kidding.
I wasn't good at listening. You know, I didn't...
How long was that movie?
It was like 20 minutes. It was long.
It's abusive.
It was a long movie.
But it was a good one.
It did well for me in the world. You know, it went to like 30 festivals. It won a lot of best films award. Best film. Yeah, you know.
That's not your thesis. That's not your non-thesis. That was your 8 to 12. Like, that was just like your first year little sketch.
I was like ready. You know, I was really ready at that point. And it was hard to hold it in. And
meanwhile, I've got like, I don't know where the lens cap is. Like, that's your host, Geekscapist. You're like
nickel and diming me for this lost lens cap.
I had maybe made movies for like shorts and stuff for a year before going to school. Okay. Which is crazy. I was on the college radio, and that's why you hear me now, Geekscapists. This is an extension of that. You know what? And so you're doing that, and I always felt like with film school, while I was there, you were an extension outside. Like, you were always one foot in. You know what I mean? Like, like, you were present, but you always had other things going on outside of it. And looking back, I do think that's true for a lot of us. But you honestly, like, you were working on productions that weren't our productions. You were working on homework that wasn't our homework. You know what I mean? You were just working on stuff that wasn't yours. And I think a lot of that does have to do with your experience going into film school. You had a bigger picture.
That's part of it. And then, I think, you know, 9/11 was like, again, like that, it fragmented my brain. You know, I was really kind of scared, and I was sort of staying to myself more. And I think I was working a lot in the... I had, like, a bunch of jobs, too. Like, I was tutoring math, and I was working the equipment room, and I was also projecting for Richard Pena, messing up his class regularly. But it's funny you say that, because I look back, and I don't necessarily regret, but I do kind of wish I'd spent... Maybe I put more of my other foot into school.
Because of the community?
Yeah, like...
You're here now. We just talked for an hour before Geekscape.
That's true.
And you're going to move out of downtown and move closer to us. That's true. Even still, it feels like now living in downtown, there's this isolation that might just be, you know, but that might be part of your process. You might need to shut out that noise.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You know, because you can be social all you want, and then you come home and you aren't doing anything. And that's one thing that I've heard about really, you know, successful storytellers. Successful anything is, like, they're the people who leave the party at 10 o'clock. You know what I mean? And that's totally understandable.
It's been more of my style lately.
Commendable.
Yeah.
Like, that's how you get it done. You leave the party at 9. You leave the party at 10. I was out with Geekscapist. You know Zach Haddad, if you've been listening to the show. I was out with Zach last night at karaoke, and 10 o'clock rolls around, and I turned to everybody. I was like, and we're out. You know, we're done. Yeah. We got stuff to do. I've got a Saturday in front of me, and when I leave here, I'm going to go write.
Yeah. Like, I look forward to Friday nights now and Saturday nights. Those are my nights I get it done, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's so funny you picked up on it. You're very intuitive. That's because when I'm...
I just remember when it was happening, because you would tell me stuff. You know, you'd be like, hey, I was on the shoot and this happened. And I'd be like, wow, where are all these shoots? Because I played GTA 3.
No, but when I picked even this place downtown, like, I was like, I'm picking this because I don't know anybody around me here. So I can be... in my space, I can work. I can be isolated in a way.
But you do. Conducive. You knew us. What are you afraid of?
Oh, you knew.
I mean, you knew us. You know what I mean? Like,
I mean, downtown. This.
Oh, you came here to not know anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I understand that. I mean? Yeah, you wanted to protect your process. You wanted to be like, hey, like, in a way, you're still doing that attitude that you gave MTV of like ride or die, where it's like, I'm going to do this by myself. I mean, I'm sitting here looking at you editing this new film. Can you say the name of it? Like, what is the new film?
It's called Staycation.
It's called Staycation, and I'm sitting here watching this couple on screen, and I'm like, wait, you shot it on, you know, by yourself, or you had a sound guy, you had some crew, but for the most part, this looks like very much a very, you know, aggressive budget movie, and I'm like, shit, I need my craft service. but I admire it, you know what I mean? And you're protecting that process. You're protecting the process that I see as a film.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, a lot of that also has to do with, you know, creating the opportunities that we want to create for the people in our community. Because the actors I work with generally are, you know, Asian American, South Asian Americans, POCs. And generally, you're not getting mainstream projects that showcase their full range of abilities. Mm-hmm. You're not getting mainstream projects where their experiences are even centered as part of the story. It's always like the sidekick, or it's even like... You know, it's just a narrative that's not theirs, you know. So if I want to reclaim that narrative, if I want to take hold of that narrative, if I want to tell that story, I have to make sacrifices for the conditions I can shoot in while I'm building that. But
yeah.
I'm also in the process, you know, making a movement, and these projects will get bigger and bigger, you mm-hmm. know, as time goes forward.
You can't stop it. And again, it goes back to what our country's experiencing now is like, white nationalism isn't going to win because you can't go back to it. We love having sex with each other too much. At the end of the day, like, dude, I saw a comment on Reddit about a beautiful woman, and it was like, I would have liked her more if she was Spanish and exotic. And I'm like, that's a white dude talking about a woman of color, and white nationalism's going to lose exactly because of that. And this is Reddit, like one of the hotbeds of that whole movement of trolling and white nationalism. And I'm like, there you go, white boy. You got your taste and you're going to get it. And white nationalism's going to lose because you're horny for people that are different. I had something much smarter to talk about. Did you see that Ed Skrein, that actor? I totally butchered his name, I believe. The actor from Deadpool who played the villain, sure. He got cast as General Damio from BPRD, who was when they're rebooting Hellboy, he had that role, and there was an outcry because John Arcudi and Mike Mignola wrote that role as a Japanese American. And if you guys aren't reading BPRD or haven't read, John Arcudi is one of my favorite writers. And it goes back to personal experience where when I started on the radio in Philly, I couldn't get anybody on the show as a guest, and because my show was on either really late at night or very early in the morning. And I reached out to Wizard Magazine for comic book creators who lived in Philly, and John Arcudi was the only person who responded and came on my show as a guest. I no longer have that tape, or I would run it here because it's a very, very adolescent geekscape. But he created this character as Japanese-American. There was an outcry of whitewashing. And Ed Skrein put out a statement and said, hey, you know what? It's come to my attention. This is not a white character. I'm not taking him. And to his credit, that was fucking huge. That's a great move. Then I see a website, and I don't know what the website was. But they were like, here are six Asian actors who can replace him. And they're the same six Asian actors who we've seen in everything. Hmm. And I'm like, no, whoa. Let's dig a little deeper than just looking on the DVD box that you've seen, like, or seeing the same Asian actors you got. What you're doing is an independent level. You're giving people opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's exactly how I like to cast. You know, I like to look at who's hungry to tell their story, who's got talent and isn't being seen. You know, who are they not doing the work to go discover? Because these are all actors that are in our community. Like, mm-hmm. they're actors. I've been playing at the Los Angeles Asian American Film Festival since 1999. I've been playing films there.
And you've been making a point to have a movie in that festival every...
Yeah, they've officially crowned me the most screened artist at that festival.
Because I first discovered that festival when Marie Chamorro had her movie in. Have you seen her movie?
I haven't seen it, but I know her.
It seems like
it's going everywhere.
She got me a DVD or a Blu-ray, and I call her the most talented person I know.
Yeah.
Because Marie's just this little powder keg of power, and she's just amazing, and she's just energy, and she's always like, you need to be shooting shorts, and you need to be doing this, and she's always up my ass about doing more, and I admit, Marie, I do. But she's just this Filipino powder keg, and I remember going to that festival and really enjoying it. And her movie's fantastic. I've got it if you'd like to see it. It's a good festival.
It's an awesome festival, and it's gained prominence in the last 5 years. It's considered one of the top 25 coolest festivals that made that list this year. They gave me a huge grant, for G&T. They gave me a $100,000 film grant, which is like,
holy,
I know,
crap.
Right? You know, like, you talk about these grants in like San Francisco Film Society and Tribeca, like, yeah, those, you know, I've never heard of a grant that big coming out of the festival.
No, because there's like 5,000, you know, there's 5,000, there's 15, there's maybe 25, and maybe you get some Kodak film, but holy crap, 100,000?
Yeah. And people, you know, people need to know this festival is legit, it's real, and it's, I consider them family. But beyond that, the kind of actors and talent that circle it, that are always around over the years. And it changes, but there's like stalwarts there. And they're very, very just tremendously talented people.
But that was going to be my next question. My next question to you was, that's the double-edged sword, is that you are making these movies with talent that has not been seen, has not been proven financially. How do you pay for these things? You know what I mean? And are you creating a... And that's what I love about... it's hard for me to call him my favorite filmmaker if I'm grasping at his name right now. Austin Bourne. And
Linklater.
And I mean, that's the thing about Linklater.
Like, you always used to say, back in the day, you would always say that. So it's not like,
this is new.
This is a true fact.
Back in film school, I would say Linklater was my favorite. Linklater
based
is
on the name, based on where we are my right favorite. Now.
But I mean, that's what I always admire about Linklater was he's like, I'm going to try something weird experiment like Boyhood. Right. I'm going to try some weird experiment like, you know, the At Midnight series, or Before and After series. And I'm going to try these weird experiments like the animated movies he did. And then I'm going to turn around and do School of Rock. Or I'm going to go turn around and do these commercial movies. How do you get are you getting called upon? Are you getting the attention to maybe get some shots at those bigger tier actors or bigger tier films? Because that's the danger, is like you make a ton of opportunities and stay at that level because the financials are so brutal in this industry. If you don't have Captain America running around in spandex, how's your movie going to make money? Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's changed a lot too. But I think actually we're in a time where your currency has to do more with your, you know, your authenticity and your artistic credibility. And you know, I've got some offers actually to do a few bigger movies. And
yeah, but is that a film? Does that authenticity cater to film, or does it cater to this new era of premium cable, where you're starting to see things like Insecure in these, so you know what I mean? Does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
I almost feel like that's becoming where this
so
is
headed. So part of my decision making process is trying to keep making projects with a lot of integrity, because that is ultimately will be the kind of show I want to make, or that's the kind of creative I want to be known as. So when the time is right to be recognized for the opportunity, for an opportunity that I can control, where I can actually be the author of the story, because I've built my audience, or I've built a quality, a signature, or like a brand of storytelling that deserves its larger platform, you know, that's going to be sort of what I'm, that's what I want to sort of keep intact, you know? So in some ways, you know, just jumping at a bigger picture because it's a chance to like quote unquote step up or be at a bigger budget, like, it's a fickle, as hard as it is to be anybody unless you're directing Captain America, it's also difficult to be somebody who makes like an okay film, or just like something that's kind of like, hey, it's flat, it's okay.
So that is a trap.
That's a trap. It's a big trap.
It could derail you.
Because we're all in a rush to get this thing or be validated.
We're all only two movies away from a Star Wars film.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they're giving these things to people who've only made one or two movies.
And beyond that, like, I mean, I get inspired when I see things like Insecure, 100%. You know, that thing went from a web series to, like, the funniest show on TV right now, you know? And then I look at Barry Jenkins, and I look at Moonlight, and I look at, you know, when you're in control of your craft and you have a strong message and you're coming from a place that's authentic, or you have a story to tell, and you know what you're doing as a filmmaker, you actually have a lot of power, you know? You have a lot of power to get a message out, to get your movie made, to tell the story you want in a way that you want to tell it. And I think it's only when we start taking in, I mean, that's how we were in film school. That's how we were used to think back in the day, you know? It's only when we start thinking in these large, like, collaborative, like, industry structures do we start kind of diluting or just get away from those original visions, you know?
Yeah, and it tugs at you until it's fallen apart, until you are diluted, until it's washed away.
Yeah.
And it will tug in different directions. You'll chase the actor, or you'll chase the money, or you'll chase the trend. I remember meeting with managers and agents who, when I was making those two projects for Fox, I had managers and agents who would talk to me, and I ended up not getting anybody because everybody was like, everybody's telling me what I should be doing, and everything that I should have been doing was the thing that made money at the box office that weekend. And I was like, oh, so you want me to work on this thing for a year so that when it's ready to be sold, that trend is already dead.
Right.
That's fucking crazy. And it wasn't, and I didn't really start getting traction again until I started writing At a Necessity again. which is scary as shit because you're fucking so vulnerable. Right. You know what I mean? Like, you're like, here it is, and you're splaying yourself out, trying to not show everybody your dirty laundry. But I've got, you know, the scripts that people care about now that I'm writing are, some are dirty laundry scripts.
Yeah, but you know, also I think like what an independent movie is today is totally different because it's 2017, you know, and it's closer to like a word processor or like a, your own little sort of writing document or piece of prose that with one author and very few people, like the collaborations come down so much that, you know, you can tell these dirty laundry stories and not... and turn them over quickly. You
because
know,
of the because of the technology and the small crew size.
That, you know, like, you're in my space. Like, there's a system that's running three or four films right here on this machine, and that's just me alone, you know? So it wasn't like that always kind of when we were learning about how to make films. And I think, like the smaller ideas lend themselves to smaller production process, you know.
When you ended up shooting this movie over 17 days. You shot in the neighborhood that it took place.
Yeah.
And then you cut it up. You told MTV no. I'm kidding. I know how those things fall apart. I know you didn't tell them no. It just, I know how those things fall apart. You project a level of disinterest, or you project, you just chase something else. That's all it is. It's like you end up chasing something else.
And you like, just made the film. Like, we just
made
the film.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's like, sorry.
And I mean, the funny thing about MTV too is that, you know, not to just put people on blast, but like, you know, we even showed them the film after we were done with the edit, and they were like, oh, this is really cool, but we're not really sure if we what we can do with it. I was in LA, you know, it was, went to the my first time at a studio, just playing it in their screening room, and like, you know,
so before Sundance,
before Sundance, yeah. Obviously, yeah. And then we get into Sundance, and all of a sudden, it's like I could have very easily at that point been like, oh, this is shit. We didn't make anything, and I didn't make the film like trying to go to Sundance.
Only based like on their disinterest, like because MTV was like, we don't know what to do with something like this.
It's a moment where you can lose a little bit of your own value. You can forget about your value, you know?
Right? Because you're projecting their corporate needs on your personal stake. That's
right.
That's,
you know,
dangerous.
Well, but you're young. It's your first film. You don't know. Yeah. You know, and you're still figuring out what it means to be like a working or a, you know, working artist. And but it's also funny. You know, MTV Films doesn't exist today.
No.
And I'm still here making films. So
you hear that?
that's for you filmmakers out there. Stick with it.
That is crazy. And Nickelodeon Films around that time put out one of my favorite movies of all time, Nacho Libre, and they never got a sequel. I was like, damn it. I did my part. I saw that movie three times in theaters, you bastards.
That was his follow-up too, right?
That was Hesse's follow-up. And then after that, I was like, uh-oh. This Napoleon guy may not be the next coming... I still believe in Jared Hess. I still am a fan of his
work. He's actually coming out in this film called Tiger Hunter, produced by my friend, and Danny Pudi's in it, Mega Kadaki is.
And that's Jared's movie.
Oh yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
Definitely. I love that. That trailer is really good.
Yeah, I've seen it.
But it feels like it's taken out of his comfort zone of weirdness, and he's telling a nice movie. Like he's telling, because like, some of it takes place in like the 70s.
Yeah, so it's set in the 70s.
And I just love
the period.
It feels
angle.
Like he's doing more than people saying weird shit to camera, which I do love.
Good in it. He really killed it. No,
I'm talking about Jared Hess's. I feel like Jared Hess got out of his comfort zone a little bit. Of saying, like, eat your food, Tina. You know, like, because he did that through, like, Gentleman Broncos and da-da-da. And this movie feels mature. Not that those movies weren't, but it just feels like a different flavor for Jared.
Yeah, I'm talking about him, too.
But it's cool. I saw that trailer, and it looks good. It's really good.
It's cool. And a lot of the South Asian actors are in that. Danny Pudi, obviously. Parvesh, Chyna, who's a hilarious, one of my favorite actors, really funny guy. And Rizwan Manji's in it, and another actor I love, Karthik Srinivasan. I mean, I know, like, they're all in there, you know, and...
These are guys who used to hang out at the festival
These are people in LA. They're great. They're great South Asian talents. And what's cool about Tiger Hunter is it's a place where a lot of these actors have come together and been able to, you know, contribute to the film.
I heard Kamal Nanjiani talking on Kamal on Marc Maron about what I think is I mean, definitely, it's probably going to end up in my top five. It may be my favorite movie of the year, The Big Sick. And there's those sequences. Did you see The Big Sick? It's okay. There's these sequences where he's, you know, his mom wants to arrange marriages for him. And they have these different women showing up for these dinners. And he was talking about the casting process and just how mind-blowing it was to have that much unknown talent that he that they're auditioning, because these women are fucking hilarious and they're killing it. I mean, there's some of the, I mean, some of the funniest sequences of the movie are these awkward arranged dates or dinners where these women come out and they talk about why, you know, they would make a good wife, which I mean, it's hilarious. And in hearing him talk on Mark Maron about like just doing that casting process and having his mind blown by just the level of talent of the comedians was amazing. I also think it makes your palate more interesting. I was like, congrats, you made a more interesting movie because it was more representative. So you put the movie in Sundance. The movie comes out. You got? Did you get distribution at Sundance? Or
We didn't get it at Sundance, unfortunately, but we eventually signed.
And then what happens? Like the movie, like...
Well, it's a tough... I mean, that was like a crazy time. You know, we got into Sundance. We got into Tribeca. We got into a lot of Asian American festivals. And you think like, oh, well, I'm here. I made it to Sundance.
Like, it's all going to roll out in front of me.
You know, but I think, you know, there's like mistakes were made on a lot of sides. You know, I think there's a few things I could have done a lot better in that moment that would have positioned at least myself better for a career, much less for a different kind of career. Mm-hmm. But I think... also, it's a reality of the game. Like, we were very small, and I was very, very young, you know. And it's the, for every Sundance success story that you hear, that's like sort of in, you know, marketed and trumpeted. There's a lot of filmmakers who kind of finish the festival, and they sit there like, "What's next?
Right.
We don't know. We're starting from zero again."
Right.
You know. And I needed time to keep growing and developing myself. Like, I had to not just develop as an artist, but also grow up as a person in a lot of ways. And spend, you know, I'd been away in India and then New York for so many years, and I kind of, you know, I missed my family. I wanted to be around, you know, the people that I grew up around.
Did it feel like you, like getting hit in the face when maybe you had this big Sundance experience, you have the big Tribeca experience, you have the that year of festival, and then the industry is like, come back and show us something new. You know what I mean? And you're just like, fuck off. Like,
well, the industry, the
like what else do you want me to do?
The industry looked different too. Like, it was 2006, right?
There was, right.
Like, Twitter wasn't what it was. YouTube wasn't what it was. Facebook wasn't what it was.
You can't foster, you know, this community.
You can't, yeah, you can't really,
unless you
can't
start
go find your people. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yo, your people were right here, Tanoosh. Your people were right here. I hear you.
You know, and I think it's even having a stronger understanding of like what I needed to put together as a team, even to and what next opportunities were out there. Like, I think here's the thing, is that you DIY it all the way to that outcome. You kind of think, well, I'll just do it again. You know, if I have to, no one's helped me get here in the first place. So let mm-hmm. me just do it again, you know? And I think, so it was a long time ago.
It's okay. Yeah, no, I get it.
It was beautiful. It was great, and there was a lot of things that sucked too at the same time.
Yeah. Right. So you go back to the Bay Area, and you
reconnect. And you look today. You know, it was just to finish up my thought is that, you know, you look at a film today like Gook, Justin uh-huh. Chan's film,
uh-huh.
Which in a lot of ways reminded me of Punching at the Sun a lot. Like, it's a super indie effort that he made about a side of his community that people don't always get to see, set in the riots. Korean black riots of like 93 with after Rodney King verdict, and it's just very lyrical and beautiful, and Justin takes it to another level, like, you know, in the tradition of Lahane and Killer Sheep and all these great mm-hmm. movies, you know, it's amazing to see what Gook's doing, because his first weekend it was out, it beat out everyone else on a per screen average,
right?
You know, and he's able to sort of get the Asian American community behind it, and it's going to second and third weekend, like, who knows, like, This film might even have a chance to be nominated for an Oscar with the way things are like opening up for people, and so it is kind of cool to see a film come from the margins and find consensus and find coalition in today's world, mm-hmm. whereas that was much less available for our project at that
right.
time.
And you did list some movies. I mean, I love La Haine. I think that movie is amazing. And Vincent Cassel is so fucking awesome in that movie. I remember as a geek watching that movie and being like, I want him to play Quicksilver. You know what I mean? Because Quicksilver is such a dick. You know, the Quicksilver in the Marvel comics. And I'm like, this guy should play Quicksilver because he's just got that attitude. And La Haine is such a... Like, he's such a... I mean, that character is... And then, you know, he did Brotherhood of the Wolf, which was the next time I saw him. And then he ended up in one of the... He ended up in one of the Ocean's movies.
Like Ocean's 12 or 13 or something.
Geekscape is... If you've seen Black Swan, he's the theater director in Black Swan.
He was in Irreversible, too. Gaspar Noé's crazy film.
He's an awesome actor.
Yeah.
But I'd heard a lot about Gook, and a couple of my friends had seen it, and it's incredible. It's incredible just seeing people just... like go complete Italian neorealism style and be like, you know what? I'm not gonna wait for the excuse of actors. I'm not gonna wait for the excuse of money. I'm not gonna wait for the excuse of anything. I'm just gonna rock, and I'll be straight up. Like, that shit scares the fuck
and
out of me.
And you know, he followed up. Like, he had a film. Justin had a film at Sundance, even like I think 2 years prior. And you know, instead of just like waiting for another film to be made, like he learned from that first festival experience, and he made it happen for himself the next time around, and he made it in black and white. And he has the little girl in his film is a girl he discovered in a nonprofit program in L.A. And then he has Joe So in it, who's a YouTube comedian, hilarious performance in this movie. Like, he's mixing so many different types of actors in it as well. And that's what it's about. Like, he has his own vision. He's not waiting for other people to give him permission. He's not thinking about what kind of reaction this film is going to have vis-a-vis all these kind of studio data about his films of the same like pedigree. He sees what the film is supposed to be, and he's taking the risk. And he's being rewarded for that now, you know. And that's where I'm at in my head as a filmmaker. So that's the kind of place I want
to
stay.
So you go to... You go to the Bay Area.
Yeah.
You sleep in your own old room.
I was in my mama's house.
You come down, but then you come down to LA, and you're still... I mean, you made that. You're making shorts for the festival.
Well, and what are you doing? I came home to the Bay, and like punching kind of... It was great too, because it put me on the map in certain places, you know, and I got to do ITVS, a Future States film, so I got my first chance to make a sci-fi project. I shot another, like a 35mm short in New York called Clap Clap with Sung Kang and Tolota Machom, which is like a pairing of this Korean star from Fast and the Furious with, you know, Indian art actress from Monsoon Wedding, which I thought was so cool in my head at the time. Like, this is like before the worlds were even that small. But, I started my own company. I created Chops Films, which became sort of a commercial and industrial filmmaking platform, you know, and I started making things like real estate videos and projects for internet companies.
You got to survive.
And I got a 5D. I was scared to buy my first 5D. I remember like being like, fuck, the price tag is crazy. And then within the first 6 months, I'd already like
paid for it
much, much more, you know?
Right.
It taught me how to shoot. It taught me how to lens. It taught me how to sort of, as indie as I was, as DIY as I was, I got even more DIY in that time and started making more money because of it. And that's when I got this opportunity to submit a script to the Visual Communications Film Festival. They had a film grant. And I submitted an idea for Chi&T, a proposal for Chi&T, which is a buddy comedy about the last two guys in Silicon Valley who have nothing to do with technology.
But because they're of color and everybody expects them to be programmers and things like that.
And they had a big search process, and out of the projects they selected Mine to Be Written, and we wrote the script, and then they greenlit it, you know. And so that's the thing that really brought me to kind of come to LA and kind of keep working on the project here. It was a good reason too.
You got the grant for it, so you at least had $100,000 for it. Exactly. And then you started putting that movie together. How long did it take you to shoot that thing?
Was still the same. It was like short shoot. It was still like 17-day shoot. Mm-hmm. But from the time I got the grant till writing, till shooting, like, it was a couple of years, you know.
Right.
It took time to put together. And, you know, while we were waiting for things to turn, I asked you, I went out and shot another feature, just low budget style.
And that's what Grass is.
That's what Grass is.
And because you got these actresses. and you're like, you want to do something? Let's do something. You want to do something? Did you shoot that on your 5D?
Yeah.
And you're like, let's do, I got a 5D.
Yeah.
I want to hang out with you guys.
I'm here in LA. Like, Pia, I know you're good. Emily, I know you're good. Like, they didn't know each other.
But you met them through the festival, or you met them through...
Just around the way. Pia was in a film I did called Clap Clap, or called Pia, for Future States. It was part of season one of Future States.
And so who had the script?
There was no script. So here's
what is wrong with you? That's crazy. That
we created circumstances. You know, okay. There's two characters. We came up with backstories for the characters, Jinky and Cam. Like, Cam is the PhD student who's like very, kind of stressed to finish out her thesis, but is also has a drug dealer ass boyfriend who's asking her to deliver a backpack full of weed for him because, you know, he needs it done and he's busy and blah,
there's
blah,
blah. There's a lot of heat on him.
Yeah.
Right. Nobody's going to suspect her.
And she's having this existential crisis because she feels like a drug mule, you know. And then
she is in that situation.
But she's like a PhD student and wants to get married to this guy. But then she's processing all this with her best friend Jinky, who's works in a convenience store, like never left town, never went to college, just has been a straight stoner since high school. And she's been Cam's loyal best friend. All these years. So that's all we started with. We started with just these two characters in a scenario. Mm-hmm. And then they're both so gifted on the improv. Or we didn't even know what we were doing. You know, we're just like, let's try things.
What's the first thing you shoot? Because that sounds crazy to me.
We go to a park and this is crazy. Looking back, it is crazy.
Because you're not even thinking like, oh, it's going to be a web series. You're thinking this is going to be a movie and this is how we start it. So you learn nothing from Lewis Cole.
Lewis is turning in his grave right now, hearing about this shit.
This isn't just not rewriting. This isn't writing at all.
But this is what I'm saying. Like,
right.
The tools have changed.
Right.
I can actually shoot it myself and write it in real time, and kind of like I slim down the process to a point where I go from thought to action really quickly. Right. So instead of writing it on a piece of paper, I'm writing it with actors in front of me.
Try this.
And so I would get this new thing I shot too, it's also unscripted, but it's a different style. But this old one, what I did is I would shoot a single, I would get a rant, I would just throw out a topic, and I would get take after take after take on the topic.
Almost Spike Lee, they're saying it to you. Like, you know how Spike Lee had those...
But it's not directly to me. Like, have the actors sort of framed across from each other.
You're shooting almost a wide.
It's like a shot, reverse shot. I'm shooting I'm shooting one close-up first.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. So I shoot
Pia's close-up first.
Sure, she's staring talking, like a little over your shoulder.
Yeah, she's talking to Emily, who's the prompt. She's like right there, so she's able to react with her. And I wish I had two cameras to do this. But what I would do is I would get take after take after take, and then I would remember the things that I really liked in one take, and then I would turn the camera around and be like, okay, respond to this, respond to this, respond to this, respond to the things that I liked in the reverse. And then in the edit, we would go in and cut the things that worked.
So F the wides, F the 50-50s, F all that stuff.
There were moments where they were where they found rhythm and they found flow, and you could get great moments in twos, you know?
Right.
And then I would go around and shoot. And so we would, you know, something would happen, and then we would go to the next scene. I would set it up, and I would just keep making turns and turns and turns in the story as we went forward. And I would shoot a bunch of B-roll as well, so I had... cutaways, and then I had a lot of transitions, and then I would shoot them doing some voiceover stuff too. So anytime I needed like a lyrical aside, I could just break into voiceover and cutaways, and I would have like texture of the film. And we broke it up into chapter markers too, so there was also like that gave me the liberty to make leaps in the story, you know, which I couldn't always film in real time. And the thing is, what you get out of that process are these amazing live, present, natural performances. And they have writing credits on it, too. Mm-hmm. Like P and Emily wrote that film.
Yeah, they wrote the whole damn thing for you. I'm kidding. All you did was edit their performances.
And the real filmmaker, in a lot of ways, was my editor, Rachel Tejada, who got an editing award for this film. Because she's, you know, I put up the rough cut of that film, and it was 13 hours.
It was a
13 hour rough cut.
No.
And I handed it to her, and I was like,
no.
Help.
No, it's freaking, it's your 8 to 12 all over again. It's your 8 to 12 all over again. You've learned nothing. You're rude. She didn't murder you?
No, well, it was helpful because then she didn't have to go through as... She didn't have to go as deep.
She just had to condense, right?
Yeah, so she could be like, "Hey, that's whack." She could easily see like what's not working. So she started pulling things out.
So she is writing it. I mean, that's kind of like, Yeah, because it's the four of you guys is just going off of instinct and
And when you see it,
but you're serious that it was 13 hours.
It was 13 hour rough cut. It was a 13 hour rough cut, and I watched all 13 hours once, like not in a row. Like I had in like
hell no.
But it's like, know, more, it's like, it's a tough watch. But
you don't do that for Lord of the Rings.
It was rough. But the thing is, when you watch the film, you like it's cut so smoothly together that you have this disorienting feeling.
How long is it now?
It's like 60 something minutes.
Oh my god, yeah. You turned it into Dumbo.
Yeah, it's short. It's a novella.
Oh my god.
It's a novella. It's, like, it's like 70 minute film. And it's when you watch it, you're like you having that debate, like, was it scripted or was it not? Mm-hmm. Because it's all the shots, it's not like verite footage. I'm not running around like shaky camera. It's very composed. Everything looks super intentional. And even the way they talk and their lines, every time they say something, they're sort of really in flow, you know. They're speaking with conviction. They've owned their characters completely because I've given them complete authority to take control of what they want to say, you know. So it feels, the words feel authentic, they feel like native to them, and they feel distinct. And when you cut it together without all the little ums and ends and don'ts that can kind of interfere with that, it feels like
a polished movie.
It feels like a written thing, you know.
That's crazy.
But it's also about the power of improv. I learned about the power of improv, and the beautiful thing about this process is when you do something like this where it's unscripted, you don't have all the answers, you don't know what the actors are going to do, you don't know even what your next shot is half the time, you know,
because the story is getting grown.
We even met people in the park that ended up cycling into the movie, and we had these great like live interactions with like random people we met, you know, and they seamlessly fit into the picture. And the thing is, what you gain from that is a tremendous amount of confidence. Because think of how much easier it is when you go back into like a big set or a big move, or, you know, a bigger project, or where you actually have all this stuff, where it's already been scripted, it's already been written. It gets you in touch with these instincts, and on one hand it makes you excited about live performance, or you just sort of see what actors need to get into their best kind of voices, you know. It's so much of that film is about creating the space for that to happen, and you can use that tool when you go out to a bigger set, you know. But I think it just, so filmmaking is such a culture of control freakism, you know, like you just want to control every part of production, you want to control the script, you want to control every little period and punctuation mark on anything. Even as a director, you're trying to like get the thing that's in your head so distinctly. But when you go through a process like this, you kind of learn how to conjure, and you learn how to allow, and you learn how to like embrace a certain, not just naturalism, but embrace what is happening in front of you and not just what your designs are on the page.
That sounds harrowing, I think. It's like, what? It just sounds like edgy, like white knuckling a movie together, but I hear exactly what you're saying, and I definitely see how, like, yeah, no, that also, what an incredibly insane experiment that, like, works. Geekscape is available now. Like, you guys can purchase the movie on what, iTunes?
iTunes, Amazon Prime, Steam, PlayStation. Both of my films are out on all those networks.
That one is called
Grass.
Grass, and so if you like to do a little puff,
a female version of Harold and Kumar, a female art version of Harold and Kumar,
which is a version of our boys, the Corsican brothers. Remember, I was just, what was it? Cheech and Chong.
Yeah.
I was talking to somebody about Born in East L.A. the other day, because at the Geekscape booth, I had this Born in East L.A. shirt that somebody at Universal gave me, and it was like an original production shirt or something, but it was all ratty and old, and I was like, I'm going to give this to somebody. And it ended up in our box, our loot crate box at Comic-Con, and somebody saw it and was like, how has nobody taken this yet? I was like, it is yours. And it was a Born in East L.A. shirt. And I guess a lot of people, especially at a place like Comic-Con, didn't know about Born in East L.A., which was the rift-creating movie between Cheech Marin and Tommy Chong, because it was a Cheech Marin vehicle after years of doing Cheech and Chong. But Geekscape is, if you have not seen Born in East L.A., you will prepare to laugh. That is a really damn good movie. Also topical right now, because it is about deportation. But, Okay, so while you're making this super indie movie where you guys are just kind of camera, sound, actors, right?
That's right.
Like mumblecore.
In a way, yeah.
Like, not even mumblecore. Like,
Yeah, it's mumblecore. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you could say it's mumblecore, but mumblecore sits in wides for so much
right.
that it's like, to me, mumblecore is you have to sit in a two-shot or 50-50 for so long, and this seems like you're sitting in, like you're crafting a mumblecore movie like a narrative, like a traditional budget narrative with like, it's almost like how Rodriguez did El Mariachi, where he was putting his zooms in close-ups in the, you know what I mean? Like he was
in a way, but even,
cutting while he was shooting.
I think even just energetically though too, like we're creating a West Coast comedic, female-driven response track to mumblecore, mm-hmm. and it's like mumblecore is so like rooted in like I feel like we're in like these like Brooklynese misanthropic kind of like tales of like nothingness. Like we're actually creating.
As, like, I always thought it was like the Duplass brothers coming out of Austin and doing that stuff.
Yeah, I mean it's it has that kind of like just roll with it kind of energy. But I think what we were trying to create is like this vibrancy around mumblecore. So it's I had never been called it that in, you know, in real time, but it is like this kind of it's trying to use the method of mumblecore to create, I feel like functional cinema.
It is insane because you're shooting them in halves. Mumblecore is
right.
That's why it sits in two shots for so long, is they're improvising together at the same time. Yeah. You're not giving it the real time. You're cutting it up, which right. is that's right. crazy.
My editor, she was very clear, like, don't do the scene without a second camera.
Yeah, I feel if you butterfly the cameras and point out, you could actually.
But there's something about like just like knowing what you want out of one lens and then being able to flip that around and actively direct the next performance to respond to that.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little more.
It's this it
style of
really
film
cool.
demands that. Actually.
I would love to do that as a short film because that sounds insane.
Well, the thing about it was we shot outside in the park during like a very hot summer. Like it was also like right. the conditions were stupid too. We had to pass out.
Well, you know what? You survived this long. What doesn't kill you? And so tell me about TNT because that's because that. TNT because that sounds like it had a bigger production around it, and you'd written that with one of the actors, or you wrote it.
So TNT is a more formal project, right? It had like a full script that got rewritten.
Also
of
available
times.
On all those platforms right now.
And TNT came out of a collaboration between me and my friend Chi Malabar, a very talented rapper who you actually know. You played basketball with him when he first moved to LA.
I absolutely used to play with him on that West Side YMCA. I love that guy.
Yeah.
Is he doing well?
He's in New York now. Yeah, he's doing great. He's a very amazing rapper.
I didn't put two and two together. Yeah. I love playing basketball with that guy.
Yeah.
I hated how handsome he was. I remember being in a Target Geekscapist and seeing his face on an ad. For like, you know, when you go into Target and you see like those really handsome people wearing Target clothes and all the Target ads and like the coupons and stuff that you get. I punched it. No, I'm kidding. I didn't punch it. I love playing basketball with that guy.
No, he's the co-writer of the film, you know, uh-huh. and one of the good things about Punching at the Sun was I got a chance to meet him at one of my screenings and we became very, very good friends, you know, since that. And we spoke every day and kind of had this dialogue going between us around, you know, his career as a rapper and my career as a filmmaker and the topics that we were interested in talking about and what was important to us about, you know, politics and the community. And out of that dialogue came an idea to make a script that's sort of around two characters that were like us, you know, Chi and T. And
you didn't want to act?
Well, one thought early on was like, oh, maybe we should just do it, you know, but then after we got the grant.
I shot this thing in a park, and it was really.
I know, right?
The next extension of it is not shooting improv and separation, but then now actually being in it. Weird.
Like, that's where I draw the line.
That'd be super psychotic. That really makes that makes me uncomfortable.
Damn, Jonathan called me out pretty hard actually at that one.
No, so you've got this.
That's true. I have more guts to do some crazy park unscripted film than I do to go in front of the camera. But once we got the grant, then we got into busy mode, really rewriting it. And then we felt like, okay, well, we have money coming into it and we're going to get some investment as well. Let's try and make a movie and provide opportunities for people who have been, you know, acting, who've been honing their craft, who really should get an opportunity in something like this. And they'll probably elevate the content too, you know, to bring more people in. I mean, it still would be fun to do it. Like, looking back, I'm like, well, it would be really fun actually to jump. Why didn't we, you know? But the kind of things that real actors bring to the project and the community we created around it was worth it, you know?
You know what I'm realizing just now? Different guy. Because Cheese the rapper, there was a guy I used to play basketball with in Culver City who was a model. That's the guy in Target that I punched.
Okay, I was gonna say, I don't remember Chi being in a Target ad, but then I didn't want to, like...
Chi could have been a model, because the dude is good looking, and yeah. I can see how he's a lead in your movie. But different guy than the Target model, who I did punch. No, I didn't punch him.
Yeah, he's not the same guy, but...
You know who else he used to play with in that Culver City? Joel Murray, Bill Murray's brother.
Oh, shit.
And somebody was like, oh, he's old, and da-da-da-da. Joel Murray will fucking freeze your ass up. Joel Murray, whenever he'd guard you, I fucking hated him. The guy, I've seen him take elbows to the face. Like, Joel Murray is a tough son of a bitch. Mm. And you think of him as being, like, 50, and he's one of those dudes who, like, just knows how to play. You know what I mean? Like, he just knows how to play, and his team always stays on because he knows how to play. And you're like, how the hell are we not beating this guy? Oh, it's because he can shoot, and he will just get in your face, and we all hate him.
Yeah.
But we love him. We love playing with him. But, yeah, that was that league. Yeah. So I just had to clear that up, Geeks Gavis. Not all Indians look the same.
But what's that? I was going to say something, and I was like, you know what? Let's just maybe he wasn't a Target ad. I don't know.
No. So this movie came about, you guys shot it in 17 days, that's like your thing.
Yeah, we shot this one in 17 days again.
The rough cut was what, 19 hours?
The rough cut was shorter on this one.
Messing with you, of course, it was scripted and disciplined on the page.
This was scripted, it had an arc, it had, you know, it had all the Lewis Cole shit in it. Third act, you know, we had a second act, third act, all, everything.
Is this something you didn't have in Punching the Sun?
No, we had it, Punching the Sun had it all too.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think... Doing Grass was great, though, because it is a comedy still.
And it can still be a movie.
What I learned from Grass was how much, like, rope you need to give actors to get to funny moments. And, like, how much funny stuff is, like, you can plant funny stuff, and then you can also see what they give you. And I had so many funny actors in Chi&T that, you know, it would, like, someone like Asif Ali, who plays my uncle in Chi&T, like, he would nail the line as scripted every single time, hit his marks, hit the comedy as it was written. But then it was always, like, at the end, it's like, well... Let's do some alts, like, let's do some buttons. These are for you. Like, what would you say, you know, at the end of these takes? And he just, you know, we kept getting variations of things. So when the edit, I could always kind of swap out something that might even be funnier or might work better.
Gives you more energy.
Grass is a film that, also my web series, Nice Girls Crew, which was another comedic, like, sort of more scripted, but improv and scripted kind of piece. And when you're just working in this kind of comedic space, I think that, you know, you have to learn how to be loose and tight at the same time.
Mm-hmm. You know? I had a filmmaker on recently, my friend Jeff, and he had that movie Folk Hero and Funny Guy, and it had like Kurt Russell's, it had Alex Kropovsky from Girls and so on, and like just the amount of like rehearsal. That is a movie that I felt. Soared because their performances, because they had a ton of rehearsal, and then they're all funny people, and on the day they were able to get alts that were really, really awesome. And then the edit is just you have all these riches, you know, instead, because I mean no offense to everybody involved in one of my earlier projects, but I remember sitting with the editor, and for a couple scenes I remember sitting there and the editor being like, we're kind of stuck picking the least bad. You know what I mean? And that's like not a good place to be. And I remember that's what led me to go into stand up in like 07, 08, 09 was because I needed to meet comedians. And I never wanted to be in a situation where I was sitting with an editor picking between least bad on a funny scene. I was like, this is miserable. Yeah. You know, and Geekscapist, you've never heard of it again.
Well, it's also one of the things too where it's like, you know, you even a comedian you have to let go, you have to let them do their thing on a narrative shoot, but even actors, you want to give them the space to also they're going to give you something hilarious too if you give them the space, you know. The thing about a 17-day shoot or like a small, like, you have to know, whereas Grass, the whole thing is like improv and funny and crazy, to make it work over a real schedule you have to be pretty clear about where your spots are, who can really do it, when you have time for it, and and when it's not necessary too, because mm-hmm. when you start creating this culture of alts on set, things can go really. Yeah.
The grip starts being a dickhead. Yeah.
the grip's got some alts too.
Yeah, it's like, oh god, no. Do you know what? Just push the dolly. This
so you do have to be strategic about it too, to also get the rest of your if you're super scripted, to get the rest of your form.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's all.
What's the movie about? Because these guys are going to download it right now.
Right. So TNT is about these two debt collectors in Silicon Valley who work for a landlord, and his nephew is coming into town, and he is having an engagement party that night. So he's tasked his debt collectors, his two guys, Chi and T, he's tasked them to get Mayank into a suit, new shoes, and a new haircut for his engagement party. Mm-hmm. And when Mayank shows up, he's just this...
A mess.
He's Tasmanian devil. He's a monster. And they're just keeping him, like, kind of on track is hard enough. So it's a bit of, like, Weekend at Bernie's meets Do the Right Thing or something. It's just, like, it's just a Saul set in a single day, and it's all about get him to the Greek kind of story.
Right.
And, they all undergo, like, comedic hijinks ensue. Mm-hmm. And then they're also, catharsis.
Right. Geekscape, that stuff is all available right now on iTunes. If you guys are on an Xbox or a PlayStation, you can download it there. The two movies are Grass and Chi and T. Dude, Tanoosh.
Yeah. And they're both distributed by Comedy Dynamics. I want to shout out my distributor.
That is awesome. And now you're working... This one looks like a love story. This movie that we have up here on the computer now.
It's a comedic love story.
It is a comedic love story. That is awesome.
It's kind of like a porno. We'll see.
Oh, I think the Geekscapists want to download that one. cool, man. Well, we're going to come back on the show when you talk about that one.
For sure.
This was way too long. And you know what? I'm not just talking about Geekscape, but I'm just talking about catching up with you. I found myself in the last month thinking about you and being like, I got to go downtown and hang out with Tanoosh. There's like, this is inexcusable that we live in the same city and we haven't hung out. And then when I saw the posting that you had two movies out this month, I was like, excuses are gone. Hanging out with the dude. I love having you on the show.
Well, man, it's also like, it's been a dream to be on this show, because it's a show that actually got me through a lot in my time. And, this is like, I'm so proud of you for making this space.
Thank you.
And I know you do more than just this show,
uh-huh.
but you have to really respect and give props to what you've created in this space, because it's awesome.
I
love being here.
And Geekscapists, we couldn't do it without you. The sellout segue would be, I couldn't do it without our sponsor either, Loot Crate. If you guys go to lootcrate.com/Geekscape, use the promo code Geekscape to get discount on all of your crates, whatever you guys order. If you want to see us opening crates, be our friends on Facebook. Go to the Facebook Geekscape page and you'll see me doing crate openings. This last one with Zach Haddad got a little bit out of control when we... you're just going to have to watch it. Go to Geekscape. Search for Geekscape on Facebook and you'll find the page. You'll also find the Facebook group that we created, Geekscape Forever, and that is your group. That is for the community. That is for you guys to go on there and talk to each other and reconnect. And there's been a lot of reconnecting because we've been around for 11 years, but... That's for you guys to talk. And there's been a bit of a Toronto like surgence on that page. A lot of the Toronto Geekscapists are giving us some superiority complexes, and I'm not down with it. We're gonna have to get to the bottom of that, good old Americans. I'm just being silly, but that is for you guys. There's also a new Facebook. There's also a new Instagram that I created for the community at Geekscape. It's really for the writers, because it's Instagram.com/Geekscapeforever. And right now, if you guys go on that Instagram and start following it, you'll see some photos from PAX West. I've got Shane and Courtney and Taylor. Tyler? I've got Shane and Courtney and Tyler at PAX West right now. They're going to be putting up articles. They're putting up Geekscape Games episodes. And they're going to be putting up a lot of pictures from PAX West. So if you guys want some video games in your life, go and check out that Instagram account and check out Geekscape Games. We're also on Twitter and all that. Tanoosh, where can we find you on social media?
I'm at Chops Films, at Chops Films on Twitter. That's the thing. Cool. And at Chops Films on Instagram. Those are my spaces.
Cool. And do you have a website where you put some of the stuff
up? Yeah, chopsfilms.com has all my work. It has all the science fiction films I've done, the web series I've done, links to get to Chi and T, and Grass and Punching at the Sun, and some industrial stuff I've done too. Lots of years of work up there, Chops Films, or on Vimeo. I also have a lot of my work up on Vimeo, too.
Cool. Dude, thanks for coming on the show.
Jonathan, thanks, man.
We'll hear from you guys next week.
We just gave each other five right there. You can't see that.
Couldn't see it, but you were a part of it. Bye, guys.